Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith, America's philosopher, we call him. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and he's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, The Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University in the Emerging Economy. And recently, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic. His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's always a pleasure.
Great. I thought today we'd do a focus on the Federal Reserve. That's been in the news quite heavily in recent weeks. And even today, we're talking on Wednesday, July 10th here. And just wanted to do a focus on how everybody has an obsession. The market itself has an obsession with the Federal Reserve as being essentially the sole driver of higher valuations. You know, is this healthy or not? It's essentially financial repression taken to an extreme. I just did a podcast yesterday between David Rosenberg, Ira Harris, and Peter Buchvar, all three who frequently appear on CNBC and Bloomberg. And we had a very similar discussion on the very similar theme. Even David Rosenberg thinks that it's going to be very extreme on what the actions the Federal Reserve will take, essentially going towards zero interest rates, more and more QE, and ultimately debt monetization, where the Federal Reserve buys whatever debt that is issued by the Treasury. And so on that theme, you've graciously provided some charts, one of which is showing how the federal government expenditures has been going through the roof asymptotic and resulting in deficit spending, essentially. So that will all continue. But essentially, the message is there that the Fed is there as a backstop. It's there to do the monetization, outright monetization of whatever debt is needed. Your thoughts?
Yeah, thank you for that excellent summary of the situation, Richard. And I guess my first response is just to go back a bit in history. And I have a chart here of the last three bubbles in the S&P 500 going back to the 1990s dot-com bubble, which burst, and then the mortgage housing bubble in the late 2000s, which burst, and now the so-called everything bubble. And what strikes me about this, as you say, single-minded obsession with Federal Reserve policy, like what's the latest easing going to be to push valuations higher, that strikes me as what happens at the top of equity bubbles, right? Because when the market seems to be relying on one driver and obsessing solely on that, that seems to mark a top. And when I think back to the 1999 NASDAQ bubble and the dot-com bubble, there was, of course, the underlying sense that the internet was going to be growing for decades. And so, you know, you couldn't go wrong investing in internet companies. But there was also like an almost comical obsession with something called the book-to-bill ratio, which was a measure of orders compared to current billings in the semiconductor industry. And the semiconductor industry was sort of a proxy for the entire tech sector at that time. And so you'd see these huge swings in equity valuations across the entire tech sector, not just semiconductors, based on this week's book-to-bill ratio. And so it was laughable even then how focused the market was on one indicator, right? Which, as valid as it might have been in some circumstances, it was like the whole market was being swung up or down by this one indicator. And then in the mortgage housing bubble of the late mid to late 2000s, 2000, you know, 5, 6, 7, then we were told, well, you know, housing never goes down. And while people were interested in what the Fed had to say in terms of the effect on mortgage lending rates and so on, the obsession was really with, you know, how fast real estate's appreciating this month.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's part of what I feel is, it feels extremely fragile here, is this obsessive concern with Fed policy as the only thing that can possibly push markets higher. So that means higher profits, higher sales, innovation, you know, higher wages. It's like none of the things that actually make a healthy economy are of any concern, and that should trouble us.
Yeah, it is, and it's almost perverse because, as you can see in the announcements of labor statistics, for example, the market is keenly looking to those statistics as a driver of monetary policy and ultimately affecting equity valuations. So that if the labor statistics are bad, then there's a sense that the Fed will be pumping more, easing more, so therefore the markets go higher. On the other hand, if the labor statistics were good, then that would translate to, oh no, the Fed is not going to give us that drug. And so we won't get it, so therefore equity valuations go lower. So it's just totally crazy and perverse. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because in terms of labor statistics and you know, whether wages and earned income is rising or not, I have a chart here that shows workers' share of the national income. And what's really striking is it's been in decline since the turn of the 21st century here in the U.S. And so in this period in which the Federal Reserve and other central banks have made the greatest expansion of quantitative easing and the greatest expansion of central bank balance sheets and massive financial repression to keep rates near zero, it hasn't benefited people that depend on earned income, which is the vast majority of people, right? I mean, certainly the bottom, say 90% of households, their wealth is based on their income, not on their equity ownership. And so it's been a disaster for the bottom 80 to 90% of households, and it's only benefited the top 10%, of which the vast majority of that is actually goes to the top 5% and top 1%. So it hasn't benefited the economy as a whole or society as a whole. So that, you're right, it's just massively perverse.
And even then, it's very fragile. The whole system, as you can see on your chart for all sectors, debt, securities, and loans, liability level, there's that little blip in the financial crisis that just seems to be a hiccup, but it caused massive financial crisis globally. And things are just getting worse. We're going higher and higher on a swimming pool plank with less and less water, and more instability. It's just crazy. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that chart up, because this is total systemic debt, basically, you know, public and private, and it's pushing $70 trillion in the U.S. And GDP is around $21 trillion, so it's over three times GDP. And what's really frightening is the rate of increase. You know, that it's from that little blip in the 2008-2009 crisis, total debt was about $55 trillion, and now it's 70. So we've added, you know, $15 trillion very quickly, and there doesn't seem to be any reduction in the rate of that debt accumulation. And this rapid rise in debt across public and private is sort of mirrored by the rise here in federal expenditures, which also this chart I have here from the St. Louis FRED database shows federal spending also had a little hiccup, right after the recession, and it was and then it's resumed its a very fast increase, and so the federal government is spending $4.7 trillion a year and taking in roughly $1 trillion less in revenues, and so here we are floating another $1 trillion a year in federal debt in so-called good times. And then, of course, we have to add in that state and local governments are also borrowing a lot of money. They in terms of municipal bonds and that kind of debt. And then there's private and corporate debt. So, is this a healthy economy that's so dependent on debt, and then therefore dependent on central banks dropping interest rates? I mean, how would you say in terms of financial repression, everybody knows the positive effects of the Federal Reserve dropping interest rates, right? But what about the negative effects? Nobody seems to talk about that. I mean, there are negative effects, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's in all different aspects, the economy, the financial markets, social implications, widening income, wealth inequality, resulting from all this, and we're rapidly approaching what central banks can do or have the capability of doing. There's other charts as well that can show how more and more debt is needed for an incremental increase in economic growth, and that is getting bigger and bigger, more and more debt needed for just a slight amount of economic growth, and that's in the economy. And then in the financial markets, if we look at the bond market, more and more of the major central banks are getting into the situation where they may be the only buyer, the last and only buyer. We look at, for example, Bank of Japan, that's been the case already for quite some time. European Central Bank is essentially there now, and the Fed is approaching that situation as well. And those areas are, it's a pretty dire situation. If you have the point where only the central banks are buying, it's basically, there's no market for that. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's, I call that mechanism a perpetual motion, machine. In that, the Japanese model and what you referenced earlier in our talk, David had said, when the central banks are going to monetize debt, then it's like a perpetual motion machine because, well, your national government can borrow $1 trillion and spend it, and then your central bank buys those bonds and they basically vanish without a trace into the central bank balance sheet. And there's no cost to society in the sense that the Federal Reserve returns much of its income to the Treasury. So it looks like it's like, well, there's nothing wrong here. I mean, why couldn't the Federal Reserve just go ahead and monetize $2 trillion a year in deficit spending and let the balance sheet go from $4 trillion to $20 trillion or $30 trillion. And of course, a lot of people are looking at Japan as the model for this, as they've more or less gotten away with this. Yeah. And everyone says, well, the trains still run on time and Japan is still a wealthy nation and everything works. And so why not monetize debt and just let your balance sheet go crazy? Who cares? And so it's hard to answer. It's hard to come up with a reason why that doesn't work, because Japan seems to be proving it does work.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, there's the two lever situation with debt, right? So that you have the quantity of debt and then the interest rate. So as the interest rates have gone down through financial repression, it's allowed governments to go on a debt binge essentially for more and more debt, much more debt now than we were at the financial crisis, for example. Problem with that is very high levels of debt, and as the interest rates creep up ever so slightly, it becomes higher and higher servicing costs, and that could get out of hand. So you could be boxed in, you know, in terms of what governments can spend. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Richard. And of course, in Japan, every few years I try to keep track of what percentage of their central government's tax revenues go to just pay the interest on their enormous sovereign debt. And I believe it was 40%. Now, this is at interest rates of basically 0.01 or less, right? I mean, you couldn't get, you really can't get any closer to zero than Japanese sovereign debt. And yet it's already consuming 40% of their tax revenues. So you got to, and that's, I'm just saying that as an example of the mechanism you're describing, that eventually, even at a tenth of 1% interest, you get boxed in because just servicing that debt makes it more difficult to take care of the rest of your social and government spending. And so and of course, the other downside is no one can earn any money safely, right? The only way that anybody can earn money is by speculating that the central bank is going to lower interest rates below zero so that your bond that you bought that's paying 0.01% will go up in value because now the rate is minus 0.5% or something. But you know, in terms of like safety and safe returns on investments for insurance companies and pension funds and so on, mm-hmm. that's also been basically destroyed, right? I mean, it's for people that are much younger, they may not remember that back in the 70s, it was a regulation that savings and loans would pay 5.25% interest on your savings. And so that was actually fairly hefty. And now, of course, it's impossible to earn 5.25% safely. You know, you're taking on enormous risks in buying junk bonds or corporate debt to get that. And so I think that's another element of fragility, you know, as well as the size of debt. In getting boxed in by the debt, we're also boxed in because everyone has to gamble now in highly risky, dangerous asset markets in order to earn some sort of return.
It's crazy. It's unsustainable. And where do we go from here? What is the way out? Another theme yesterday that was discussed is essentially inflating. There's only essentially one way, is to inflate the way out to make that burden of debt less burdening by increasing the inflation rate much higher levels. Your thoughts?
Right, right. That's what a lot of us have been anticipating. And of course, we know for a variety of reasons, governments understate inflation. We think the real world inflation is, as you and I have discussed many times, running more like 6 to 7 to 10%. Instead of the 2.1 or whatever the official rate is. But we've all been anticipating that. And I think what's interesting is there's got to be a deflationary element in the system that has been offsetting the inflationary impacts that should be registering in terms of deficit spending and money creation and so on. And so, it could be that, like, say, going back to Japan as an example, that deflation is a factor in Japan because their workforce is shrinking, so there's less consumption and there's fewer drivers to push up real estate and equities. There's just fewer workers, and so then you get deflation in consumer prices than in assets, and then you also have a huge overhang of bad debt from the Japanese bubble of the late 80s. And so as loans are defaulted and get written off, then that's also deflationary. So it makes me wonder what happens if you don't have any deflationary impacts, then we might get a inflationary shock if, say, the federal government decides to pursue modern monetary theory ideas of huge stimulus programs, universal basic income, and we can bandy about numbers in general. It's like maybe a limited universal basic income would probably add about $1 trillion to federal spending, and then it's pretty easy to add $1 trillion more in infrastructure and other fiscal spending stimulus. So if you're going to create and push out $2 trillion a year in a $20 trillion economy, I think maybe you will finally get inflation.
Yeah, and it's, if you look at one of the great thinkers in the Austrian school of economic tradition, I was talking with Ronald Peter Stovall of Incrementum a couple of weeks ago. He wrote the book on Austrian school investing, and he pointed out that Murray Rothbard has the view of the three phases of inflation. He was one of the great thinkers in the Austrian school, and he says, first we look at the monetary inflation. So we've had a lot of that. That then goes into asset inflation. Obviously, we've had that and still have that, a lot of that. And then the third phase is consumer price inflation. So it eventually all comes into consumer price inflation. So that 8 to 10% a year, roughly, where if you look at the Chapwood index of inflation that more accurately measures inflation than any other index, including government statistics, that indicate 8 to 10% per year inflation in most of the U.S. cities, that is likely to get higher as time goes on. Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought up Rothbard's work in that, because a lot of people, I think, have been lulled into a false confidence that we can basically create essentially endless amounts of new money or credit, and there's never going to be an inflationary impact because we've gotten away with it for 20 years, or in the case of Japan, 30 years. But that may be a false assumption. I want to mention a social impact here that, when we talk about finance, we have to remember too that there's a social impact to this kind of financial repression of jacking up asset valuations with quantitative easing and super low rates. I spend some of my time in the San Francisco Bay Area, and as we all know, there's many real estate bubbles. Where you are in Canada, and Vancouver as well, and the West and East Coast, many West and East Coast cities in the U.S. are reaching just absurd levels of housing valuations. And so like approximately 5% of the population in the San Francisco Bay Area can afford a house there. And of course, this is a region with very high incomes. And so say the top 5% income in the Bay Area is I believe it's north of 400,000, where in the rest of the U.S. it's more like 250 or 300,000. So you have to make really enormous sums of money to afford a bungalow right in the Bay Area. And so there was just a what's the net result of this socially as well as economically? And yes. And so this what one social result was, there was just a poll that was published in the San Jose Mercury News that said 60% of millennials in the San Francisco Bay Area, in other words, people around 30 or under, want to leave or plan to leave the Bay Area in a few years.
Wow.
Because there's just no point in staying in a place where you have no future, where you're going to be struggling to pay the rent, and that's it. You'll never afford a house. And they had they had a young couple that had scrimped and saved and worked two jobs and so on and bought like a little bungalow for $700,000 a few years ago. And they their quote was worth thinking about because they said, we're working at 150% to maintain a lower middle class life. Mm-hmm. In other words, it wasn't like they were really getting ahead. So that's the social costs of central banks pumping up assets in order to please the current owners of all these assets, right? Mm-hmm. I think that that's going to cause social disorder on a massive scale at some point.
Yeah, and also have a feedback loop into the whole problem to making it worse, because if you've got this effectively a brain drain happening as well as some level of wealth drain as well, you know, as the millennials leave some economic activity representing that. And this is not just in the Bay Area. I see it here in Toronto. There's lots of articles and charts showing it for all over. In particular, by the way, with Chicago and Illinois, what's happening there, the millennials will not likely be as idealistic as they've been portrayed, but they will leave. They will begin moving out. And this will make the whole problem worse, because then there'll be more draconian financial repression, higher levels of taxation, and just making the whole thing, you know, worse, and so on and so forth, and cause more and more people to drive out. So that social problem and effect that you just mentioned could get worse. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's, as you say, a feedback loop. I just got an email from a reader in Chicago, since you mentioned Chicago, and he said his property tax has gone up by 48%, partly from valuation, but partly from higher rates. And so he says, I don't know how many people can withstand this kind of increase, you know, and that, it's... the Federal Reserve, we were talking, can monetize sovereign debt, right? The Treasury can issue $1 trillion in bonds, and the Federal Reserve can buy that. But what about real estate? There's, you know, the roughly $15 trillion in real estate, private real estate in the U.S. Is the Federal Reserve going to start buying houses in Chicago to prop up the house values there? And so, and in other words, I guess my point being that the Federal Reserve and other central banks have a pretty easy mechanism for propping up equities and bonds, because they can just monetize the bonds, the debt, and they can just print money and buy the stocks, right, as per the Swiss central bank and so on. But the vast majority of people's assets in the middle class are in their house. And so if the housing bubble pops, then what's the Federal Reserve going to do? Well, they're going to lower interest rates to try to create negative mortgages where, you know, if you take out a mortgage, you'll end up getting paid. I'm not sure how that's going to work. Great. But I guess my point is, I think they're really pushing on a string, because you can't prop up all asset bubbles everywhere without basically, as you say, destroying any notion that there's a market there at all.
And so where does this all end? I mean, it seems like it's a lot of doom and gloom, and maybe we can end on a positive note from your recent book on Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic. What ideas and concepts do you put that come from that book that can apply to what we've discussed in terms of a positive way out or a potential positive outcome? What changes need to be made to the Federal Reserve or to the economy, financial markets, in your view?
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. I think the core concept here that a lot of people realize or share the idea that this is the way forward would be to decentralize capital, decentralize banking, decentralize political power, and so that that would render the economy and the financial sector much more flexible, and so that you could have in Nassim Taleb's conception, you'd have a more anti-fragile economy and a financial system, because you'd have a lot of variation in there, because it was freed to be a market again. And so if we had, say, 1,000 banks instead of 5 or 6, then, you know, that would be a way forward, I think. And if the Federal Reserve, it's almost impossible to imagine, but we can at least dream of it returning to its original purpose, which was simply to be the lender of last resort in financial panics where there would be a liquidity crisis. If the Federal Reserve could return to that role and stop being the prop under equity values, we could restore the flexibility that's inherent in markets and decentralized political and economic control, because then you can respond to local conditions, and losses, when they are, you know, created, can be taken without putting the entire system at the risk of collapse, which is what happens when you centralize capital control and banking. And so that's really the ultimate risk we've created here, is we've centralized everything and made it much more fragile.
Wow, great insight in how we can possibly get out of this from your recent book. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Charles?
Yeah, visit me at oftwominds.com. There's there's free chapters of all my most recent books, so you can read the first couple chapters for free and see if they're of interest. And all my archives and essays are free.
Great. Thank you very much, Charles. We'll do it again.
Thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.